Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu. You're listening to Chronicles and Commons, and in this episode I want to talk about technology of Barsoom. So I've been doing the Barsoom series lately, as you may or may not know, and one of the things I haven't really touched on yet is what kind of gear and equipment they have on Barsoom. So first of all, as you've possibly gleaned from my descriptions of things so far, this is basically a post-apocalyptic world. That's something that is pretty clear throughout the series, that Mars is a dying world when we arrive on it with John Carter. And as I understand it, and I could be a little bit mistaken, and maybe a historian could set me straight on this, but as I understand it, Mars being a dying world was something that was kind of put forth pretty early on in history. I mean, Mars itself has kind of been a known planet for hundreds and hundreds of years. It was one of the original, you know, sort of otherworldly bodies that people very early on recognized as a thing. When they started really looking at it closely with telescopes that started to get more and more advanced, someone pretty early on, like the 1600s, maybe 1700s, thought, hey, this could be, it might be a little bit later actually, but either way, like certainly before the 1900s, it was proposed by someone that, hey, Mars looks kind of like there could be, I think they thought that they were either canals or roadways, and they just kind of postulated that maybe it was a world that had existed and had fallen into decay. So Edgar Rice Burroughs may have been riffing off of that idea, and so there's kind of a weird, there are lots of different layers to this, but there's kind of a weird sort of future regression happening on Barsoom, or there's that kind of indication that there might be a future, a retro future on Mars. And then, of course, on top of that, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment, but on top of that, of course, there's the fact that we are looking back at the future interpreted by someone in the 1915 or so. So lots of weird, like, you know, even what they think would be advanced, we think is archaic. So there's that influence. But just looking at Edgar Rice Burroughs at the Barsoom novels as Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote them, we can say that the technology on Mars is centered around fairly traditional, quote unquote, technology. I guess you could even just call it mechanisms that you wouldn't really think of as something in a science fiction setting. You'd think more of a fantasy setting. So you've got swords, lots of swords, you've got horses, and so on. There are some guns, they do make an appearance, but it seems that one of the favored weapons of the Martians over guns is actually, you know, the swords and stuff. In fact, if my memory is accurate, and it rarely is, I don't remember there being guns in the later books. I remember there were guns in maybe the first, maybe two or three, and that was about it, as I recall. I mean, I wouldn't swear to that, and maybe a gun is mentioned here or there. But even in the first three books, even then, it was very obvious that the preference was the sword, even though there were guns available. But for close combat and such, they defaulted to swords, and there was a lot of close combat in the first three books, and that tended to be, you know, it was very sort of a pirate type thing where even if you're or what I think of as pirate combat, even if you're far away, then your goal is to get close so that you can then switch to melee combat. So that's a pretty standard trope within the books, that they really like the mano-a-mano kind of combat. Let's get up close and kill each other like civilized people. So lots of horses, or rather thoats, as you've learned in the previous episode, they are the exclusive means of ground transportation, as far as I can recall from any of the books, and certainly in the first three or five. So that's the typical vehicle of choice is a thoat. For hauling things around, you're more likely to see a larger beast of burden being used, such as a zitidar, which are the sort of big woolly mammoth type creatures. Can't actually guarantee that they're woolly. I've always seen them as woolly mammoth type creatures. Either way, they're very large, they're very hefty, and they can pull a lot of weight. So none of that qualifies really as technology. The cities where they live are mostly, well, I should say the cities where the green Martians live are mostly gutted out, sort of upcycled cities. As I've said before, I'm not entirely sure whether the cities inhabited by the green Martians were gained by them through conquest, or whether they simply moved into them because the civilizations that had once thrived in them had kind of fallen into ruin. I'm not 100% sure which interpretation we're meant to have. But that's where they exist, the green Martians. And then the red Martians have, it is implied, a lot more structure to their cities. Although each city is mostly self-standing, sort of an independent entity. And that there's some suggestion that either I guess a suggestion of a kingdom or a province, because you'll find places that when they're first mentioned, I sort of imagined them as a city. So for instance, Manator was in my mind a city until later in the book in which that appears. You realize that there's a neighboring city called Manataj, but that the two cities are sort of one and the same. So it's almost like Manataj is a province of Manator, or maybe Manator and Manataj are both provinces of the bigger Manator. So, for instance, Manator is the name of the kingdom. The capital city is Manator, and then there's another nearby city called Manataj that is at, by characteristic of being in the same kingdom, is an ally and a maybe even swears fealty to Manator. So I'm not exactly sure about the sort of social or zoning laws of these places. But there are, let's call them kingdoms, and those are those seem to be features mostly of red Martians, although you kind of get some indication that yellow Martians have that as well up in the north. Oh, and white Martians as well, they have that. Black Martians, I don't get the sense that they do, that they seem to be those sort of underground slash in the valley dwellers, and the same goes for another group of Martians whom I haven't really mentioned yet. So, and I will mention these other Martians, these mysterious other Martians that I keep teasing at. So, you have cities, and the ones that the non-green Martians and the non-black Martians manage seem to be filled with modern conveniences, more or less. I mean, there's not really great descriptions of I don't know, elevators and air conditioning. I guess those are the two modern conveniences I can think of. But you never get the sense that it's completely medieval either. And in fact, I would say that you get the sense that it's on par, certainly with 1915 expectations. That's just my interpretation of the lack of anything saying otherwise. Now, one thing that they do have, and it's important to note this, and we're not completely sure of what kind of ramifications this has, but there is a discovery that Barsoom has made, the different societies of Barsoom knows of this energy called the eighth Barsoomian ray, or the ray of propulsion. And the ray of propulsion is what they use on Barsoom for their flying machines. And yes, they have flying machines. They have small one-man aircraft, and then they have great big galleons as well. and I'm not sure that I'm using the word galleon correct. I'm not sure how big a galleon is. I just know that it's big and can hold lots of people. And so that's kind of what I'm using to associate with what these are, because these big flying machines, there's quite a lot of action on them in the, I guess, second and third book, maybe mostly the second, really, The Gods of Mars. And it's very much, I don't want to belabor too much the Star Wars analogies, but if you think of one of Jabba the Hutt's barges, then you might kind of get the idea of what sort of size and probably more or less what kind of shape and spirit these flying machines on Barsoom take. Now, I can't really speak for the design, like the literal visual design, because Edgar Rice Burroughs doesn't go into it quite to that degree, but we certainly know there's a deck where people can walk around. There's the ability to jump onto another craft and board it and have melee combat. So you get the sense that it's not really like a blimp, for instance. So you can't think of it as like a blimp, because that would be inaccurate. It isn't that. And I feel like the fact that the name of the city, the main city from which these when we are introduced to these great flying machines, the name of the city is called Helium. So I feel like there's this, at least for me, there was this early desire to think of these great flying machines, associating the name of Helium with them. They must be filled with air or something, and they're kind of blimpy and big and round. But that wouldn't be correct, because these are very easy. You can walk on top of them. You can walk around, fight people, kick them off, and so on. So I think it's more like a flat deck, like a sailing ship probably, but propelled in some way by this eighth Barsoomian ray. All the eighth Barsoomian ray apparently can do is propel. Now, presumably it propels buoyant objects. So if it's something that already floats, then it can be propelled by the eighth ray. I assume that the object has to harness the energy of the eighth ray somehow willfully, and that if you throw something into the air, the eighth ray doesn't just grab it and propel it. I feel like that's a safe assumption. Now, I'm not 100% sure whether the harnessing of the eighth ray has to be mechanical, or whether it can be, I don't know, something other than that. For instance, the reason John Carter can jump to great heights, which, by the way, kind of fades out of, it kind of falls out of the story, really, as by the, like, the second, it starts to trail off in the second, starts to really trail off in the third. I mean, I think John Carter might use the ability sometimes, but it's not really a thing after a while. It kind of gets quietly dropped. So the fact that he can jump to great heights is because, apparently, because he's from Earth and he's used to different gravity or something like that, and so he can make these great leaps and bounds on Barsoom. Now, I don't know, for instance, because it is described that he can jump very, very far. So to me, it almost suggests that he is somehow harnessing the eighth ray. But I could be wrong about that. And here's one great reason that I could be wrong. In a way, the eighth ray and this ninth ray that I haven't mentioned yet is really just a form of solar energy. And the eighth ray and the ninth ray are really, it's essentially ultraviolet light, ultraviolet light. I mean, you could probably argue that it was X-ray, but I think it's really fairer to say that it's ultraviolet. So, and I don't know when ultraviolet was discovered and so on, but the idea here is that the eighth and the ninth ray it starts at the eighth because there are already seven in front of it, which is R, red, orange, yellow, R, Roy, G, green, B, blue, indigo, and violet. So the colors of the rainbow are there. And then beyond the spectrum of visible color or light is this eighth ray, which for whatever reason propels things that are floating, and a ninth ray, which propels or drives machinery we see the ninth ray in action. We don't really see it, but we see the fruits of harnessing the ninth ray in the factory where air is produced for Barsoom. As I've said, Barsoom is a dying world. Its atmosphere is fading, and in order to continue the atmosphere, in order to sustain it, they had to build a bunch of machines that would continuously produce air for the entire planet. This is at the very end of the first book. You get a pretty good tour inside of this factory, and you understand that the ninth ray is separated from the other rays of the sun by means of finely adjusted instruments placed upon the roof of the huge building, three quarters of which is used for reservoirs in which the ninth ray is stored. This product is then treated electrically, or rather, certain proportions of refined electric vibrations are incorporated with it, and the result is then pumped to the five principal air centers of the planet where, as it is released, contact with the ether of space transforms it into atmosphere. So a bunch of technobabble, 1915 style, and it really, really works. So that's the ninth ray at work. Now, why they don't use the ninth ray for machinery within their cities, I don't know. But then again, we also don't know that they don't use the ninth ray in their cities. And I think it's quite possible that they do, that it's just kind of glossed over. And again, just sort of the expectations of someone writing about the future in 1915 would probably realistically and reasonably incorporate the modern conveniences of 1915. So you might not have a refrigerator, but you might have an ice box. I'm assuming, yes, ice was absolutely invented by then. I know this because Back to the Future 3 had ice. So there's little things, you know, radios and communication devices, whatever. There are things in cities, I'm assuming, that you would just think, okay, this is set in the future. I'm in 1915, so the future looks like this. So that's kind of what I imagine when I think of the cities. And if you've ever seen any kind of bad black and white science fiction Buck Rogers serial from the, not serial like breakfast cereal, but serialized fiction from the early days of cinema, then you may have some idea of what I mean. And I think it's reasonable to expect that, yeah, there's electricity and rudimentary technology at play within the cities. So eighth ray for propulsion, ninth ray for, I guess, electricity slash mechanization. And that, as far as we know, that's as many rays as there are. There's the light spectrum, there's the eighth ray for propulsion, ninth for mechanization, and that's it. Now, whether or not that is it, obviously, could be up to you as the story creator here. But certainly Barsoom lays claim to 8, 9, that's it. I think that's it for technology, too. I mean, there's not a whole lot more I can say outside of here's how they derive all of their power from Mars. I mean, it's all in the sun, obviously. I think, in a way, this is really, really excellent fiction. This is brilliant, I think, science fiction fodder. You know, this is, I mean, the technobabble of splitting rays of the sun and harnessing that energy, I mean, no one can argue with that. That's brilliant. And furthermore, the more we learn about energy, you know, the more some of that almost makes sense. Just kind of like, well, was he kind of talking about radioactivity? I mean, is that what he was kind of driving at? Was that what he was thinking? Was he thinking of actual, like, cosmic waves in space? Like, the actual movement of particles through space? Based on gravity, like, what was he, who knows what he was thinking of, but it all sort of works out. It starts to sort of formulate somehow into, yeah, that actually sounds right. And none of it involves microchips or anything like that. Like, you don't have to sort of go down this fractillion kind of, just trust me, at some point little circuits are breaking and making bigger things happen. It's all very natural and kind of, well, there's a machine that gathers energy from the sun and then makes stuff happen. Like that, we have a very, very real life sort of equivalent to. And whether you divide it into 8 or 9 or 13 rays doesn't really matter. You can come up with all kind of a ray for this, a ray for that, you know, like who cares? We can use a prism to split up the rays of the sun and call them whatever we need to for whatever situation the fiction requires. I think it's just a super elegant way to tackle technology and Barsoom of the many great ideas that the Barsoom novels contain. I think that the basis for the technology is one of the kind of the more intriguing ones. I mean, it's almost Maria Corelli kind of logic. I mean, it's ever so slightly mystical and sort of like just have faith that nature has this ability. We just need to know how to harness it. But it also has just enough nature where it does make sense. And there's a lot of flexibility in that because we all know that we don't know everything about nature. So who knows what's possible? I think that's it for me. Next episode will be about some very specific events in the Barsoom novels. And that'll be it, I think. So for the year, for everything. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.